Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In 2016-2017, while working for the USA Today Network's Wisconsin investigative team, author John Ferrick wrote dozens of articles examining the murder case against Stephen Avery, who had already beat one wrongful conviction only to be charged with the murder of Teresa Hull back in 2005. The case became the wildly successful Netflix Making a Murderer documentary. In Wrecking Crew, Demolishing the Case Against Stephen Avery, Ferrick lays out in exacting detail the post-conviction strategy of Kathleen Zellner, the high-profile, high-octane lawyer, to free Avery. To write this book, Zellner, perhaps America's most successful wrongful conviction attorney, gave Ferrick unique access to the exhaustive pro bono efforts she and her small suburban Chicago law firm dedicated for a man she believes to be a victim of an unscrupulous justice system in Manitowoc County. The book that we're featuring this evening is Wrecking Crew, Demolishing the Case Against Stephen Avery, with my special guest, journalist and author John Ferrick. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, John Ferrick.
Thanks for having me on again, Dan.
Thank you very much, John, for this incredible. Congratulations on this book. You've got yourself involved with one of the most fascinating cases in American history. Let's talk about, just briefly, how you came to be in a position to be able to speak with Kathleen Zellner. We just spoke about this unique access. Tell us how you came to be involved with this. We talked about the investigative team that you were involved with. Tell us how you came to be involved with writing Wrecking Crew.
The Making Murder came out, as people may remember, it was late December 2015, and it really took the world by storm. I was in a position on that investigative team where I had a really tenacious, hard-nosed editor, Joel Christopher, who had some familiarity with the original trial of Stephen Avery and Brenda Dassey. And Joel was a real bulldog and really wanted me to basically independently do whatever investigative reporting that I needed to do to really try to investigate some of the key facts of the case, the Teresa Halbach murder case, involving Stephen Avery especially. And it was shortly thereafter, I think it was just within a couple weeks of Making a Murder coming out, Dan, that Kathleen Zellner announced to the media, announced to the world for that matter, that she was going to take on Steve Avery's case. Coming from Illinois, being born in Illinois, and having a brother who's a lawyer here in Illinois, I had some familiarity with the name Kathleen Zellner. She had been involved and made a name for herself around Chicagoland, championing justice for people that had been wrongfully convicted. And there was one case in particular, the Kevin Fox case, which is not that far from where I grew up in Joliet, Illinois, that was already familiar to me and my family. So I had some knowledge of who Kathleen Zellner was when pretty much everybody else around the world didn't know who Kathleen Zellner was, except that she had come forward and was going to take on this case and this crusade, this quest on Stephen Avery's behalf. And so from that point forward, I really tried to do as many stories as I could to try to chronicle, follow Zellner as far as just what you know, what avenues, what she was exploring with her defense work. And it took me several weeks, if not months, to eventually you know, be able to have a phone interview with her and speak with her and let her know that that I was really looking at this case independently, Dan, and not from a jaded point of view, or but as somebody that really wasn't there. I wasn't in Wisconsin at the actual time of the Teresa Halbach murder, that tragedy, and so I didn't cover Stephen Avery's trial, and I didn't cover Brendan Dassey's trial, but I also felt that being from the outside, coming into the case fresh, that gave me an opportunity to look at the case fresh, just like Zellner was doing.
And she's from Chicago as well, so she had that same perspective or that the advantage of being an outsider as well, looking at it with fresh eyes. You mentioned in the book, too, something, I mean, very unusual and very, well, tell us about Kathleen Zellner's experience with a serial killer and what she did, which is so untypical as an attorney.
That was one of her first cases that dealt with the criminal justice system. She had made lots of money and worked, kind of her bread and butter was the medical malpractice industry, and did really well for herself in that industry. But she got involved in at the request of an appointment from one of those groups that gets funding. They got her involved in a serial killer named Larry Eiler, and she was appointed Larry Eiler's counsel. And she realized, Dan, as she was digging into the case, that he had only been convicted, I believe, of one murder at that point in time, but was suspected of being involved in many, many more, at least 15 more than that. I think it was even higher than that. But anyway, so she was kind of in that quandary where she's thinking to herself, you know, she was uncovering a lot of information, a lot of evidence that she thought was helpful, you know, on his behalf as far as in the appeal process. But from an ethical standpoint, you know, from an, you know, trying to do the right thing, she wanted to try to figure out how to make the best of the situation, and that would be to find a way to help the police and close a lot of these cases that Eiler had never been prosecuted for. All these, they were still unsolved murders on the books, so to speak. And she eventually, you know, convinced him, got him to confess to her. He was dying. And she got him to confess to her all these other crimes in great detail, too, just to make sure that it was legitimate confession. But she was able to get him to confess all these other crimes, and in order to help the police and get those cases closed and bring closure to those families. And I think that's really something else. That's something that you don't expect and you don't envision a criminal defense attorney normally doing. But Kathleen Zellner is not your normal, you know, prototypical criminal defense attorney. But she also had a revelation as a result of that experience, you know, or maybe an epiphany for that matter. But she realized that she did not want from that point forward to be representing people that were so-called guilty, you know, guilty suspects, guilty murderers, like Larry Eiler was. She knew he was a killer. He was a serial killer. She learned that. And she decided that she did not want to do that type of criminal defense work from that point forward in her career.
Right. Now, in this, she had also, from that point, exonerated, became a famous exoneration lawyer. At one time, Steve Avery found out about her through his then-girlfriend. She was then contacted by her unsuccessfully. A few years later, Zellner got in contact with the girlfriend and then hence went to see Stephen Avery. Now, involved in this case, and just like you involved in this, as you say, in an independent investigation, tell us about some of the things you found out about Teresa Halbach that nobody knew about at the time and rightfully should have been investigated and taken into consideration, as you do in the beginning of Wrecking Crew.
It's one of those things that you know, Dan, and I think probably a lot of others that have devoted, you know, many years of their lives to investigating true crime, especially homicide detectives, know this. One of the proper ways to do an investigation is you start at the beginning and you do what's known as victimology. Oftentimes, victimology leads you in the right direction as far as, to answer the question of motive and why somebody became a victim of a crime. And the Teresa Halbach murder, there really wasn't any of that, regardless of whether or not people believe Steve Avery and or Brendan Dass, who were involved in the case. The fact is that there really was no effort, there was no investigative effort at the time of the crime to really do a lot of what I would consider, you know, homicide investigation 101, and that is, you know, study the victim, learn the victim's, you know, habits, traits, mannerisms, and patterns of life. And so because of that, there were a lot of people that were in Teresa Halbach's life, and she also was involved in what we would consider a lot of risky behaviors as well. There was a number of individuals that she was involved with romantically. She got involved in she got involved in a court case involving another couple that were married that were going through a divorce, and she had taken nude photographs of them at her photo studio, and in the middle of this messy divorce, Teresa Halbach got pulled into this case regarding these photographs. And again, around the time that she disappeared on Halloween of 2005, one of the first things that the police did was, go through her house and they recovered or confiscated, these photographs that were in her bedroom, these negative photographs. So, there was just, again, a lot of that information, for whatever reason, never came up and really was never developed at the time of the 2005 investigation, and it certainly wasn't brought up at the time of Stephen Avery's trial, for whatever reason.
Let's talk about one thing that comes up in the documentary, but also comes up in your book, but I think it's important to mention, and you do this in the investigation, that you wanted to find out the particulars of the work that she did. She worked for Auto Trader, but she also did independent work. And we talked about, you write about in the book, that she was branching out into her own business where she would do nude photography. And so she was doing other things other than the Auto Trader assignments. And one of those was called Hustle Shots. Tell us what Hustle Shots were and what they entailed. Be important.
Hustle Shots were a way to make some extra cash, so to speak, and it was money that somebody would flag her down or contact her or track her down on her cell phone, and then she would use her creative skills and do featurey photos, but it really was could be anything and everything. I mean, usually it was related to the photography for Auto Trader, but again, it was more of a sporadic, spur of the moment, kind of on a whim type of assignment, Dan. And because of that, that really would be hard for her employer, her independent contractor, Auto Trader, for example, to really kind of know what she was doing on a hour-by-hour basis and stuff like that. And again, she was an independent contractor. She was not a full-time employee of Auto Trader. So because of that, she had a lot more liberty and freedom. And again, some of those assignments with the hustle shots sometimes could put her in a situation where, somebody might proposition her or some guy might try to, invite or entice her to come inside their cabin or their house or their trailer, for a couple of drinks, and we kind of know where sometimes those things go and stuff like that. So again, it was a lot more of a risky situation, for her to be putting herself in, in that rural area. And I know that the fellow that she worked with at the photography studio back in Green Bay, Tom Pierce, had some reservations and some skepticism, you know, about her, you know, doing a lot of this auto trader work. And, you know, certainly that would include some of those hustle shots.
Let's fast forward to, obviously people know that she was missing as of October 31st, 2005, but let's go to November 3rd, just a few days later, in Calumet County. And a gentleman named Kevin Ramlo, and he lived nearby, and near Mishicot. So tell us what he sees and what he reports at that time and what he notices regarding that RAV4.
Yeah, and again, this is something that never came up at all at the time
right.
of the original trial, and so it's completely foreign. And again, he had moved away from Wisconsin, I think, within a couple years. So he really wasn't, a junkie, or as far as just somebody that was really interested in the case. It was just something that he learned. He had experienced and realized years later, you know, what had occurred. And that basically was that within shortly after Teresa had disappeared, her friends and family members had got together. And among other things, to try to get the word out, they made posters. There were different posters that were distributed, but one of the posters had a couple different pictures of Teresa on it, and on the bottom, Dan, it had a photo of her Toyota RAV4, and again, the friends and family were trying to put these in as many locations that made the most sense as far as people were going to see, and so gas stations and convenience stores were obvious logical places to stick these at. And so Ramlo just happened to be visiting the Senex convenience store gas station later in that week, and he saw this poster, and it caught his eye because when he saw the picture of the vehicle, he realized that this was a vehicle that he had seen, I would say stashed, you know, kind of, you know, parked in an abandoned area, a remote area, along the two-lane state highway, which was pretty much, you know, one of the main thoroughfares. It's Highway 147, kind of out in the rural rural Manitowoc County area there. And so he sees this poster, and you know, light bulb goes off in his head. And then there's another part of this story that's really fascinating for people that are interested, that have familiarity with Making a Murder and some of the key players. Ramlo, who had seen Making a Murder finally by this point in time, and I'm talking a year after the original Making a Murder came out, had realized that the face that he saw, the deputy that he saw, was one of the individuals that was a key person that was you know, well known to the world in Making a Murder, and that was Andy Colburn. So he is unwavering, I'm talking about Ramlo, that he saw Andy Colburn at that gas station that day, that he saw the poster, and let him know, well-intentioned, in a friendly type of tone, but just let him know that the vehicle that there's a poster for here happens to be a mile or so down the road, so to speak, and he basically told Colburn, you know, where this vehicle was. And as I know now, apparently this was sort of common knowledge back in the rural Manitowoc area around the time that this was going on. It just never came out at the time of the 2005 investigation. This apparently was never, there really were not any police reports or very few, you know, it just seemed to disappear, even though it was factual and a lot of people had come forward in the county that thought they saw this green, or, you know, I'll just say turquoise, that's the way it's described, but this turquoise RAV4.
You write that he saw this, he believes, November 3rd and 4th by the dam. So a couple days.
I know it was over a two- or three-day period, yeah. That's
yeah.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time, there's other information that is uncovered, of course, by the Zellner investigative team. And while we're on this same still area that everybody will know what we're aiming for, basically, there is another person named Joshua Randit, a gravel pit owner. Well, tell us more about Joshua Randit and what he says he experienced. Again, tell us how the conditions or circumstances in which this team found out about this, because this was not initially known either.
I was going to say, yeah, Radant is Josh Radant. His family for generations, I would say, has owned several of the sand and gravel pits that are surrounding. They're basically behind the Avery's 40-acre salvage yard. And with Radant, one of the key observations he had made was that he had seen on that Halloween, so Monday, around the time frame that Teresa disappeared, but later that afternoon he thought that he had saw, you know, some type of fire, something off in the distance back at the Avery property. And he came forward as part of the Zellner investigation to give an affidavit to explain to her that he felt that he was being pressured by the police at the time that he gave his initial story to kind of change his story to give the impression that that the fire was really at Stephen Avery's, and he felt that what he saw was really probably a fire coming out of a burn barrel, and that it was probably closer to Steve Avery's trailer and property, and that's commonly known as the Dassey property. There was also information too that Radant had shared with Zellner that some of the state Wisconsin Department of Justice investigators had spoken with him and confided in him, and basically left him with the impression that Hallbeck's vehicle, you know, was found or had traveled or was in the general vicinity of his property and an area that's known as Cuss Road. So again, some of these are all revelations that really were not commonly known or common knowledge at the time of the original case. And one of the key points, too, is that Josh Radant, again, was one of the first people to speak with the police after the RAV4 turned up on the far back edge of Stephen Avery's property. And Josh Radant ultimately was never called by the prosecution at the time of the Steve Avery trial. And you see that with a lot of witnesses that, for whatever reason, they had information, important information, but they never made it on the witness stand at the time of the trial.
Let's talk about the Dassey brothers. There's four: Brian, Bobby, Blaine, and Brendan, which was 16 and convicted, of course, everyone knows. Let's talk about what Zellner and obviously you had found as well in terms of Bobby Dassey and the computer and the searches. Tell us how you introduced experts that, of course, the information in 2005, if it were to be analyzed, would not have the advantage of today's technology and these experts and utilizing that technology. Tell us what they found and via what method. Tell us what they found out about Bobby Dassey.
Well, one thing that was known at the time of the original investigation was that shortly after Steve Avery's arrest, we're talking a couple months later, but the main computer of his nephew and the other brothers, that was taken into custody by the police. Zellner, years later, obviously 2016, 2017, 2018 here, but she's been able to determine that there was all types of really creepy, disgusting, violent pornography that involved also mutilation And there was just a lot of this this dark, I would say, dark web type of material. And this all really pointed to Bobby Dassey. He was the second oldest of the boys, and he was also the one that that maintained that that he was pretty much sleeping all day, and just happened to wake up right around the exact time frame that Teresa Halbach rolled up on Avery Road to take the photographs of Bobby Dassey's mother's red van, the one that was being advertised through Auto Trader. So you had Bobby Dassey basically being the star witness for the prosecution for Mr. Kratz, and ultimately taking the stand and telling the jury that he saw Teresa Halbach walking toward Stephen Avery's trailer, and maintained that he never saw her again. But again, you have a lot of these inconsistencies. The computer expert that Zellner was able to bring into the case, a gentleman by the name of Gary Hunt, was able to get access to this computer again over the last year or two, 2017, 2018, I believe, and using today's modern technology was able to determine that there was a number of Internet searches that were taking place on the day of the murder, and basically Bobby Dassey was the only person that was home at the time that these Internet searches were taking place on the web there. So again, it's just one more key example as far as whether or not Bobby Dassey was being truthful at the time of the crime. There was also another affidavit that that came up, and I'm going off of memory here, Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was either the older brother or it was his half-brother. But one of the Dasseys came forward and said that Bobby had told him around the time of the crime that Stephen Avery could not have committed the crime, that he saw her leave the property. And again, this was something that was never really followed up by Stephen Avery's criminal defense lawyers at the time of the trial. And again, this is something else that if they had put the other Dassey on the stand, that would have undermined Bobby Dassey's testimony, and would have shown that he was either just outright lying or just giving some type of statement that questioned and undermined his credibility there.
It's not only you go further, and what you write about in the book is that she had hired experts to psychologically analyze the kind of person would make these kinds of violent Internet searches, keyword searches for dismemberment, women tortured, dismembered bodies, like I had mentioned. So all of these things that were proven to be attributed to his searches and his searches only. The images that they found on there, including files called Halbach and Teresa and DNA, and some questions about that. And also the idea that you said that he was searching violent porn all morning, refuting the claim that he was sleeping until 2:30. Now, tell us what Zellner says in terms of the reason why Bobby was not questioned more so and why Brendan was chosen, before we can get to the idea of more evidence against Bobby and also pointing towards Scott Tadich. Tell us what her idea was, the reason why Bobby was not looked at more closely and Brendan was. What was the reason for that, in Zellner's estimation?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, along those lines, Dan, one of the key points was that Stephen Avery, the investigators, had pretty much locked in on him, from the get-go. He was really the only person that was seriously being investigated as a suspect. The other thing, too, I remember was that John Dietering, and I know this is in the early portions of the book, but basically these investigators had really befriended Bobby, and they really wanted him. They were trying, I would say, trying to groom him, you know, to be a star witness, a crucial witness against against his uncle. And so they even make comments to him, you know, at various times that they don't think that he's involved, that they can't see him, you know, being an accomplice or being involved in the crime. And so I think for those reasons, you know, Bobby Dassey was overlooked, you know, as a suspect. But again, when you look at some of the experts that Kathleen Zellner has hired, you know, and brought into the case, studying this, you know, these mutilations, you know, these very sick and twisted, you know, images that were on his computer, you know, the belief was that this kind of fits the profile. You know, as I think one of our experts, Greg McCrary, had pointed out, as far as that, I mean, some type of sexual, sadistic type of, you know, killer, and there have been a number of these individuals throughout the country, and again, you know, in Zellner's mind, you know, Bobby Dassey fits that type of, you know, profile or persona, and some of our experts agree and believe that's. I believe that's the case here. The other thing too, and I don't know if this was something that you picked up on too, Dan, or not, but one thing that Zellner had also zeroed in on was that Bobby Dassey basically was trying to assure the police that, hey, you know, I just happened to, you know, look out the window and I saw Teresa Halbeck, you know, but it really was nothing. And then I went inside and I took a shower and her vehicle was still there. And then I left and went hunting. But Bobby Dassey was also able to provide very, very detail about the clothing that she was wearing at the time of the crime, at the time of her disappearance. And Zellner also picked up on that and realized that, you know, these are things that, again, only a killer or you know, prime suspect would seem to pay attention to and really zero in on and stuff like that, rather than just somebody that again, nonchalantly, just happened to look out the window for a half a second or 2 seconds. So again, this idea that Bobby was standing at the window, you know, to Zellner, basically solidifies her belief that he was stalking her, Dan, and you know, really, you know, he had been watching her and observing her over several times. I think at least a half a dozen times that she had been on the property. And I know there were some comments that have been put forth in the post-conviction motions by Zellner, even suggesting that Bobby was the one that was really, you know, had kind of fallen in love or, you know, was really seemed to be wrapped up or hung up on, you know, obsessing and paying attention to Teresa Halbeck whenever she would show up, you know, at the Avery property to do her regular, you know, photographs for Auto Trader.
Absolutely. We're going to talk more, but we're going to stop for a break to talk about Blue Apron. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Blue Apron achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. You choose chef-designed recipes. They deliver fresh, seasonally inspired ingredients. And you can cook incredible meals in as little as 20 minutes. Every week, at least 3 recipes built with your busy schedule in mind, where Blue Apron has done the meal prep for you. Prepared sauces, spices, and ingredients. Quick and easy recipe options with insanely delicious flavors. Blue Apron lets you choose from a range of recipe options. Whether you're looking for quick and easy meals or a full culinary cooking experience, Blue Apron is there, letting you choose from a range of recipe options. My wife and I cooked the hearty vegetable grain bowl with avocado and a creamy fig dressing. I was intrigued just by hearing the ingredients. And this is freke, which is an ancient Middle Eastern grain. It's basically young wheat seeds toasted, but it's combined with Brussels sprouts, toasted sweet potatoes, and apple and avocado. And with this fig spread, put together ourselves buttermilk and Dijon mustard. Incredible, amazing flavor. Never would have dreamt of this in a million years. I've never ever seen this on any kind of menu. Fantastic, and we cooked it ourselves. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free at blueapron.com/murder. That's blueapron.com/murder to get your first three meals free. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Now, John, we want to get to what Kathleen Zellner has put together in terms of what really happened with Bobby Dassey that day, Stephen Avery, and Teresa Halbach. Take us to the timeline that she creates through this and is described in Netflix, but in more exacting detail in your book, Wrecking Crew, about what she believes happened and how.
Well, you basically, we put ourselves around 2:30-ish or so, okay, Dan? And
right.
So it's 2:30. Teresa Halbach shows up to perform a very, you know, routine, you know, photo assignment for Auto Trader that pretty much would take her in and out of the property, you know, within about 5 minutes or so, okay? And so, again, according to Zellner's theory and what her investigations uncovered, Steve Avery goes outside, and that's important to stress. Avery's always maintained that Teresa Halbach never went inside of his trailer. And again, just to remind listeners too, it was pretty much taboo. You know, it was that the Auto Trader photographers were not supposed to go inside of, you know, homes, you know, or trailers or apartments of people that. So again, you know, that would seem to line up as far as you know, that any transaction of money, you know, took place outside, you know, in the yard. So let's just say that it happened that way, that Avery pays her the money. She got the photo assignment done within a couple of months or so. And again, we know based on, you know, Dassey's own statements that he's watching from the window, you know, kind of peering out the window no matter what. Okay, he's watching this take place and stuff like that. Okay, mm-hmm. We have Teresa leaving then, so she pulls back up Avery Road, which again is probably about a quarter mile long. It's a longer road than you realize until you're out there. But it would probably take her another minute or two to get from where she was taking the photographs to actually getting back to Highway 147. Okay, it's a state highway, 55 miles an hour, 2-lane road. There's usually not that much traffic out there, actually, believe it or not. You would have her taking a left and basically going up the road about a mile or so, and then you would get to an intersection that's called County Highway Q. And while this is going on, basically the belief is that Bobby Dassey got in his own vehicle, his black van, and followed her, to chase her down. And the belief is that somewhere, again, not that far from the intersection I just described, which is County Q and State Highway 147, not that far up the road would be a little half-mile two-lane road, a very, very, very seldom-traveled road. There's only about a dozen houses on there, and it's woodlands on both sides of the road. A very desolate area that's called Cuss Road. And the belief is that Bobby Dassey perhaps had flagged down Teresa. You know, again, it's middle of the daytime. It's around 2:45-ish or so. And, you know, flagged her down. And under the guise of, you know, asking her to photograph his vehicle for what's known, again, as we talked about earlier, as a hustle shot. And again, Teresa Halbach being familiar with him, you know, familiar with the Avery property and stuff like that. If it had gone down, if things had happened that way, that would not have set off any panic alarm, you know, or left Teresa Halbach, you know, fearing, you know, that the end was here and stuff like that. Because again, Bobby Dassey would have been a familiar face to her, and she would not have expected anything terrible to happen to her at this point in time. Okay.
Right.
The belief is that, so again, we're on Cuss Road, or we're basically around Cuss Road. And again, one reason why that this theory seems to line up, Dan, is that Zellner's forensic experts, you know, have analyzed the phone calls, and Zellner's belief is that the very, very last phone call that came to Teresa, the one that took place around 2:41 p.m., would have that phone call bounced off of a cell tower, which is commonly called the Whitelaw Tower. Whitelaw is a real small community, not that far from where we're talking about. But that tower is about 13 to 13.1 miles away from the actual Avery Salvage Yard property. So again, it wouldn't make sense for the call to be bouncing off of there unless Hallbuck was in the same general area where that call had had taken place. Okay, we're putting them now on Cuss Road. The belief is that Bobby basically suggested, or she agreed to, let's just go right up the road there, because there really is a huge cul-de-sac up the road on Cuss Road there. It's a really wide area. I've spent some time out there this summer, took a lot of photographs, and just kind of walked the area from my own experience. But so that area there, which also, again, leads into the very back, there's kind of a, I would call it, it's not really a secret entrance into Redance, but it's a way that some of his trucks and also some of his friends, people that go out there, it's a back way into the Redant Quarry property, and it's also a back way into, he's got, or at the time he had three or four different deer trailers out there for people that were deer hunters. It's kind of a deer camp area. So anyway, the belief is that Hallbuck was lured out to this area there. And, again, she's getting her photography camera ready. She's opening the very back of her RAV4. She opens the door. And the belief is that's at that point in time is when Bobby attacked her. Again, he may not have, if he did the crime, he may not have done this with the intention of a premeditated murder per se, that this really was possibly a sexual rape. It was a violent act. But anyway, nonetheless, is that she's attacked, she becomes unconscious, knocked out, incapacitated, and the belief is that she eventually is later brought back to the property, to Bobby Dassey's garage, and it's there where she either was killed or some of the dismembering was going to take place and stuff like that.
You talk about a phone call that stepfather, new stepfather Scott Tadich, and this is Steve Avery's sister's new man in her life, Scott Tadich. He worked at a aluminum smelting foundry or aluminum foundry. Tell us a little bit more about that. But he got a call on October 31st, and apparently, according to what investigators have found, is that he left the premise that day. Tell us more about what the phone call indicated and also what was concluded from it.
Well, there was the situation with Tadich is a little some of it's still a little shrouded in mystery, so to speak, then, Dan. The the phone call that he got, I'm going off of memory here, but I'm pretty sure there was one that took place the following week where somebody called him, and this was the voice that was in kind of a panic mode and stuff like that. That was actually, I believe, the following week and stuff like that. But on the day of the actual homicide of Teresa Hallbuck, Scott Tadich was a no-show. He didn't come to work that day. He was regularly scheduled to work at the foundry. And different versions were floated around, the office. I shouldn't say the office; it's a blue-collar, facility. But back at the foundry, and one version was that Scott was supposedly going to make a trip, I believe, to Green Bay to see his mother because she was going to be going through some back surgery that day. So he's going around, and after shortly after the crime had happened, he was interviewed on a number of occasions by the police, and different stories that came up as far as his own whereabouts that day, and one of the things that he said, which is really a kind of an unbelievable tale was that he stuck with the version that he had made a trip to Green Bay to visit his mom, and then he claimed that he decided to come back to Manitowoc County and to decide to go deer hunting. So again, you know, he's supposed to be at work and blows off work, and he claims that he's going to go deer hunting. And he claims that that while he just happens to be driving back on 147, which again is the same general area, you know, where Hallbeck, you know, is her last moments of life are, you know, are possibly taking place. He's going to claim that that he happens to be driving in the exact opposite direction of Bobby Dassey, you know, and he's going to claim that they both just happen to pass each other, again, driving 55 miles an hour, not knowing, you know, that one or the, you know, that they're going to see each other. But what's really odd about this whole story, and I know it's going to go on a little tangent by saying this, but I want to bring it all back to Bobby Dassey too, is that when Bobby was first interviewed about the case and about his own whereabouts, his behaviors on Teresa's last day of life, he was the one that brought up the fact that that he and Tadich had supposedly passed each other on Highway 147. The one thing I noticed, I really picked up on this, is that when the investigator, or investigators, I should say, had asked him about this, to have an understanding of where this happened and along those lines, I noticed that their statement that they put down was that he said that they should ask Scott Tadich, that Scott would remember. And in my mind, again, from years of doing this type of work, Dan, that was one thing that I kind of zeroed in on and really red flagged, because we're talking less than a week after Hallbeck had disappeared. This is not going back 15 years earlier saying, you know, what were you doing in, you know, 1987 or something like that. This is fresh. This is within, you know, that prior week. And he can't tell them. In fact, he's actually encouraging them and directing them to go out of their way to interview Tadich, which again, in my mind, you know, raises a very strong likelihood that these two guys had cooked up a story and basically, you know, had everything kind of put together as far as, for each other. Because again, if this really did happen, you know, why is Bobby Dassey struggling to tell them, you know, where he saw Scott Tadich at the time that this is fresh in his mind, at the time that this had really happened? And again, the other thing, I take my dog for a walk usually 3 or 4 days a week here in Illinois, and ever since this case, since that topic, I've spent a lot of time studying. There's a busy road not that far from my neighborhood, and the speed limit's 40 miles an hour out here, Dan. And I look out the car. I know a lot of people in this general area, in this community, and I can't, even, you know, standing outside on the, walking the dog on the sidewalk, I struggle to see who's inside those vehicles. Even every once in a while, if somebody beep at me or wave at me, and I can't, you know, see who that really is at that point in time. So I just struggle with this whole idea that these two guys really saw each other, you know, going in the opposite directions like they did. It just really seems to defy logic.
Now, Zellner goes farther than just saying that this is a case of obviously ineptitude, that this is a conspiracy involving certain players. And we don't have time to go through all of those, but people that watch the documentary know some of the names of Coburn and Link and some of the people that were around when Avery was first convicted seem to be, as you write in a book, rewarded for their work and their loyalty, and then are in a position again to show their loyalty in terms of seems gathering evidence against Avery. You talked about some of the things she's found. We could all spend all day on the things that she refutes, like the no blood in Avery's trailer, the entire theory of Kratz's prosecutorial theory about how things went down. But let's talk about what Zellner found and you found in terms of the bullet and in terms of the garage never being the Dassey garage never being searched, and also the idea of the what you call a cover-up in terms of the roadkill in the Dassey garage. Tell us a little bit about that, the bullet in the garage.
Yeah. Well, Yeah, and again, the well, that's one of the amazing things too, because if you think about it, the police had control of the Avery compound, the 40-acre property, you know, from Saturday, November 5th of 05, through that Saturday, November 12th. And they had already spent two previous days before that actually making trips out to see Steve Avery, you know, and interview him, and then they came back on the 4th, Link and Remaker did. They showed up that Friday morning, and Steve gave them permission to walk inside. So now we're really talking almost 10 days. And they also spent a lot of those days going into the other trailers of his brother Chuck, and also going into the, you know, the house of Barb, his sister, and her boys as well. So it really kind of defies logic that they were checking some of these outbuildings. I know they were doing that on that first Saturday on November 5th, but for whatever reason that they weren't curious or weren't looking around at the garage immediately, the garage of the Dasseys, just, you know, as part of their due diligence, and what was in that garage. And they photographed this at the very end of the case when they were kind of closing up shop at the property, but there was a dead deer that was hanging from the rafters, so to speak. Actually, I shouldn't say rafters, it was hung up, but it was hung pretty high. And but the thing was, again, that this was another one of the strange events of the case, that this wasn't a deer that Bobby had bagged, you know, out in the field, but this was a deer that he had picked up on the side of the road, and he only picked this thing up on the 4th, I believe. I'm pretty sure it was on that Friday. So again, now you're talking 4 or 5 days. Four full days after Teresa had been on the property. But by that point in time, Bobby Dassey and pretty much everybody in Wisconsin, for that matter, Dan, knew that Teresa Halbach was missing, and they also knew that Steve Avery was being looked at as the prime suspect in the case, because you had Wisconsin television personalities and reporters showing up at Avery's property, I believe on the 4th, and there was an interview that was done with him where he's kind of a little, I don't think he's teary-eyed, but just he makes a statement along the lines of, you know, that he's fearing this is going to happen again to him and stuff like that. So everybody in the world that was paying attention to television that night, including if there was an alternative killer here, they would know at this point in time that Steve Avery is being looked at as the prime suspect, but he hasn't been arrested at this point in time. So again, you have all these factors, you know, going on here. But again, if you're somebody that may have been involved in the crime, and you know that Steve Avery is being looked at, well, one thing you're going to want to consider doing is to take the heat off yourself. You don't want to draw any attention, you know, to yourself. And again, this whole notion that Bobby Dassey's going to, you know, go, you know, start the engine for his vehicles, you know, for his van, and then drive around and then go find a dead deer carcass that he doesn't know who hit the dang thing, which also then, you know, raises the question, how the hell long had it been out on the road and stuff like that? Because again, as somebody who hit a deer in May of 2016 in Wisconsin and destroyed my van, but again. The goofy notion that you're going to pick up a deer from somebody that you don't know who hit it and or how long that thing's been laying there on the side of the road, and then bring that thing into your garage, and, you know, and it just, the whole thing again is just very, very, very suspicious and stuff like that. But again, it would be a perfect ruse, so to speak, I would say, if you don't know if the police are going to eventually come back to the Avery Road and eventually start asking questions, you know, of you or your brothers or your mom or, you know, her boyfriend and stuff like that. If Teresa Halbach had been dismembered, you know, and her blood was spattered throughout the garage, what would be a perfect cover-up? you know, aside from putting a rug on the ground there, and again, you throw a rug on, you know, in the garage, that's going to look suspicious. But again, hanging up a dead deer, you know, that's pretty much been skinned, you know, and taken apart, that's gonna draw some attention away from you and stuff like that. The police would think that that's normal because that is normal. People do that. Thousands of people do that, you know, in a given week, you know, at that time of the year in November in Wisconsin.
Let's talk about the burn pit. Zellner got a forensic fire expert with incredible experience. Tell us what he had said about the possibility of Teresa Halbach being burnt in Avery's burn pit, and also the idea that they found out about three locations of bones in a gravel pit near Custer.
The burn pit's an interesting one, and I have some familiarity, too, from actually having walked out there on the property and taken some close-up photographs just in the last year or two with permission from the family, because I myself wanted to get an understanding, Dan, of, you know, how this could have happened. And was it logical that you could have, you know, a bonfire out there that got this hot and would have, you know, basically burned up a body under those circumstances. Again, early November, late October, you know, at a time that's usually in the 30s, you know, or 40s at nighttime and stuff like that,
right,
too. But again, Zellner got a couple different experts. John DeHaan was one of them. And John DeHaan,
right,
I know, is regarded as one of the, you know, the foremost experts, you know, in the United States and maybe even the world, as far as he's actually done numerous examinations, numerous experiments, let's call them, dealing with cadavers, to study cadavers under different heat, different intensities of heat. And the one thing that you normally need to have a body incinerate to the heat that's going to cause the body to break down like that, but also you need an enclosed setting, and usually a car or a car trunk or a steel drum barrel is the logical place that would take place. And again, her experts have studied all the property, studied the case, and the other thing too, this is important to stress for people listening, the Avery's burn pit was really close. His garage, which looks like, you know, a 10-mile-an-hour wind would knock the thing over. It's just a real rickety-looking garage, but it must be sturdy because it's still standing, you know, 12, 13 years later, even though it looked that bad back then. But his garage is just rickety, but his garage is right on top of this burn pit. And not that far away from that, Dan, is actually there's a propane tank that's not that far away. And then right next to the propane tank is his red trailer. So you have all these four things right next to each other, generally speaking. The burn pit in the backyard, the detached red garage, the propane tank, and then the red trailer. And the notion that somehow Avery, you know, was going to throw this body into the burn pit and have the body destroyed within a 3-hour period from like 8 to 11 p.m. or 7 to 10, whatever it was, John DeHaan is 100% sure, positive, that the crime didn't happen that way. That's not saying who the killer is, but it's just saying that the factual allegations or the foundation that was made at the time of the trial in 2007, the crime, no matter what, did not happen the way that it was portrayed at the 2007 trial. And again, this isn't just, you know, some armchair quarterback here or somebody on the internet, you know, that's on Reddit. This is John DeHaan, who's one of the best experts, fire experts in the country, that's making these conclusions and is willing to sign his name to a sworn affidavit on this topic, Dan.
Along with that, they examined the bullet, and found that there was no bone. Tell us what the significance of finding no bone attached to that bullet, and what did they find attached to that bullet, which was very interesting and explainable.
Well, you had, again, Zellner went out and tracked down another one of the country's best experts, ballistics experts, a gentleman in Arizona. Luke Haig is his name. And again, they did numerous exam fire, ballistics expert, ballistics examinations as far as firing bullets through what was bovine. Because again, if Teresa Halbach was shot in the manner that was described, it was portrayed at the time of the trial, the belief is that there always is and would be some type of bone, you know, from the skull that would have even just tiny fractions,
sure.
You know, of
yeah.
But there should be there would be there's an absolute certainty that would have been on one of these bullet fragments if indeed the bullet fragment did pass through her skull. Okay, and again, they did these experiments and then they also analyzed a different forensic expert was able to analyze the bullet. And that was Chris Palentik. I believe he's with MicroTrace, which again is one of the country's top experts dealing with trace evidence. Just has unbelievable microscopes there, and was able to put this bullet under their specialized microscope, and they were able to determine that there's some type of wood particle, Dan, that was located on this bullet, and I believe also some type of red paint. But again, the expert was convinced as well, again, absence of any type of skull fragment and the finding of these wood and or paint chips. The belief is that again, going back out to the Avery property, that this bullet or bullet fragments that were recovered from the garage were probably bullets that had just been fired out there by a fellow that actually had owned the trailer, a guy named Raleigh Johnson, who had lived in the trailer before Steve Avery got out of prison in 2003. But Raleigh was notorious. I shouldn't say notorious, but he was just fond of firing his guns at just different varmints and rabbits and squirrels and just other animals that were running around out there and stuff like that. So it was not uncommon for the Averys to be firing, shooting at different animals and stuff like that. And the belief is that one of these bullets that was just lodged inside of the red garage, the garage that eventually Stephen Avery inherited when he got out of prison, moved into the red trailer, that the police had basically just plucked one of these bullets out of that garage and then declared that bullet was going to be one of the bullets that somehow was used to shoot Teresa. And again, it's one of those other unbelievable, I think, forensic Herculean feats that Zellner and her experts have been able to really illustrate, for the court to, kind of, again, take apart some of these key pieces of evidence that 10, 12 years ago, nobody was even really given serious consideration to the possibility that these were phony or ginned up pieces of evidence, Dan.
Yes. She cites a bunch in her conviction appeal, post-conviction appeal, October 3rd, 2017, in front of Judge Sutkiewicz, she outlined a bunch of Brady violations. And number one was a CD of a couple named Zipperers that we didn't mention, but at least noting that Teresa Halbach was headed to another appointment and that the Averys were not the last appointment. That was suppressed, and now that CD is gone. The second thing was very interesting was Teresa's fuel tank, the consumption was never analyzed. And she says that would be, and that's because they didn't want to have any anything disproven in terms of the mileage and what it revealed in terms of where she might have went in that vehicle, and it wasn't supporting their theory. They also, she also talked about the highly questionable flyover that was conducted November 3rd that did not find the vehicle. And she has assertions and contentions regarding that as an intentional miss in that flyover. And then number four, the affidavit from the quarry owner that we mentioned, that he talked about, that he said that the district, the Department of Justice had told him that the RAV was driven through the, that property from the Redant property itself. Tell us what Judge Sawetsky, what were her decision was October 3rd, 2017, and why.
Well, I was going to say, there's really not a whole lot to say because she really didn't give much detail. In fact, I'm going off of memory here, Dan, but I think that her total ruling was only about seven pages tops. And so the long and short of it is just that she didn't agree with Zellner's petition or her arguments, and that she didn't find anything that convinced her otherwise, as far as that these were pieces of evidence that the prosecution had intentionally withheld from the original trial lawyers, Jerry Buting and Dean Strang. And it just, like I said, for a case where Zellner had originally filed, you know, about 1,200 pages of filings asking for permission to do scientific testing on different items of evidence back in August of 2016, to her eventual filings in 2017, you know, where she got into more detail about these Brady violations that she had uncovered. The opinion that was rendered by Judge Sukowitz was just really, you know, shallow, and it really didn't offer much detail as far as why she came up with these conclusions. And you compare that to the federal judge, the one that originally had ordered Brendan Dassey out of prison, you know, in August of 2016, and that Judge Duffin's ruling was around 90 pages or so. So this, again, just regardless of, you know, what you believe about the case, Sukowitz's opinion, in my opinion, just basically sent the message that this is somebody that really didn't want anything to do with this case. She really wasn't going to roll up her sleeves and really analyze the evidence and even have a, you know, study this case, you know, like we're studying this case, Dan, and stuff like that. In fact, and I know this is a very small detail, but I put it in the book just to stress, you know how she really wasn't in touch with this case. But she actually, in a written ruling that again is a legal opinion, you would think that she would get the names of people right in the case. And at the end of her opinion, she makes a reference to Stephen Avery's nephew, the one that's convicted in this case, the one that whose conviction had been overturned by the federal judge, and she refers to him as Brandon, B-R-A-N-D-O-N, which again is started calling me, you know, Joe or something like that, or Jim, and I'm John. So it's just that sent me a message that if she's that lazy or sloppy, you know, about not even, you know, knowing the proper names, you know, when she's being punctual, when she's actually writing this down and then looking over her work before she, you know, files this thing with the court for the whole world and all the lawyers to read, that she's also somebody that was just kind of a flyby that really probably doesn't know the case and really hasn't dissected the case. And that's just a disservice for the whole, you know, state of Wisconsin and for everybody that's interested in justice, regardless of whether or not, you know, who you believe are the killers, you know, or not, and stuff like that. This is just somebody that really was just phoning it in on this case. And it's just pathetic, if you ask me. So,
despite that, you said that Zellner was positive and upbeat. Tell us what she assured you, John. And why would she be upbeat? Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, one thing is that she's still, I mean, as we're probably having this conversation right now for our listeners, I'm sure she's probably back at either at her office or at home, or, I mean, she's constantly thinking about this case, and she's still doing analysis. She's still working on this case, you know, as we speak. So, in fact, actually, Zellner usually has a lot more success on the appellate level than she does back at the circuit court, the district court level and stuff like that, because of the simple reason is that a lot of these judges on the lower level, you know, don't want to become involved, you know, or don't want to ruffle feathers, or just really just aren't looking at the case properly. So Zellner oftentimes has her best success at the appellate level when there's, I would say, you know, the cream rises to the top. So oftentimes the state, you know, the appellate judges or the Supreme Court judges at a different state, they're a lot more experienced and really are in a more, shall we say, neutral position where they're not going to be worried about local politics or, you know, bumping into the prosecutor or different people, the sheriff's deputies, you know, at the local grocery store or Walmart like, you know, Judge Chuckowitz might be. So, again, Zellner has had a lot more success on these appeals, you know, at the appellate level. And I just think that it's just one of those things that she's basing it on her own experience, that she's been there before. And she believes, I know she believes this, Dan, that if she can convince a court to grant her an opportunity to put on evidence, you know, not even to the point of a new trial, but just letting her put on, you know, what's called an evidentiary hearing, that she believes that she'll be successful at that level and that that'll ultimately cause the prosecution's case against Stephen Avery, you know, to collapse to the point where the prosecution will not want to even retry the case if she is successful at that evidentiary hearing and a new trial is granted. So, again, she's just a very tenacious individual that she becomes even more successful through some of the defeats, you know, and losses that she's had over the years and stuff like that. And again, it's she's just very upbeat and positive about Avery because she believes in her case. She knows that all these pieces of evidence that she's been studying and she has the experts to back her up on, you know, really makes things look real good for Steve Avery at this point in time.
We also didn't go into some of the evidence that she was able to get from the new experts that she brought on board, but some of the more compelling evidence is and also offers an explanation that the confounded Strang and Buting at the original Avery trial, and that was concerning the theory that they put forward that the blood that was planted in the RAV4 was from a sample that turned out to be not the source of that DNA. So she goes and does the investigation in this, and you chronicle all of it, where she gets the blood spatter experts. They do the experiments. It's shown in the documentary as well. It's gone into more detail in your book about exactly what they found and how they found that. So she has done an exhaustive job with her investigative team, and congratulations, John, you have done the same with this book, really explaining the case for Kathleen Zellner to be able to exonerate Stephen Avery at some point. And she has said, you write in the book, she said to her followers, maybe 500,000 on her Twitter account, to hang in there because she believes he's innocent and that she will prevail. Isn't that correct?
Yes, it is. Yeah, and again, it's one of the things that tomorrow may be the day somebody else will come forward, a witness will come forward, or it could be a week from now. So it's one of the things that she hasn't stopped doing her investigation, you know, and she's even just in the last month or so, Dan, gone back into the Dassey garage, if I'm not mistaken, and taken some samples, and is still, again, she's doing the work that the investigators didn't do back in 2005, and wouldn't that be something? You know, if lo and behold, that analysis that she's doing right now on the, you know, on the garage floor would really turn out something like Teresa Halbach's blood on the ground. So we'll see.
Absolutely. I'm sure that I'm certainly convinced that Kathleen Zellner is the person to be able to free Stephen Avery, and I am even more convinced of everything that I've read. And we talked about there are people that believe that certainly Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey are absolutely, unequivocally guilty. But this really, really opens your mind to the good possibility of a conspiracy by judicial officials to frame Steve Avery once again. That's been incredible. I want to thank you very much, John Ferrick, for coming on and talking about Wrecking Crew, demolishing the case against Stephen Avery. I know this is a Wild Blue Press release. Tell us how they might find out about your other work that's been featured on this show and find out about this book.
Yeah, I was going to say the opportunities out there for people. Oftentimes, just go to wildbluepress.com, and again, three of my other books that I published with Wild Blue Press are available there, including my 2016 book, Failure of Justice, which chronicles the largest wrongful conviction case in the United States' history, six people that were wrongfully condemned in the state of Nebraska for a crime they didn't commit. The other opportunity is just go to Amazon. You could pretty much find all five of my true crime books on Amazon as well. And again, oftentimes I've written about wrongful conviction cases. I've studied a lot of these cases and just really have taken an interest in this type of work. So again, Amazon or Wild Blue Press are probably the two best places to go.
Well, thank you very much, John. It's been a pleasure, a great pleasure. Thank you very much, and congratulations on Wrecking Crew, demolishing the case against Stephen Avery. An incredible work. Thank you very much, John. Hope to speak to you again soon. You have a great evening. Good night.
You too. Thank you very much again, Dan, for the opportunity. Have a great night.
Thank you. Good night.